Did anybody else purchase a bicycle during this pandemic? We did at the Fiedler household. I'm an inline skater. I've been doing it for 40 years, skating. But my wife, Sydney, wanted a bicycle, so we loaded up and went to the bicycle shop. And given the constrictions of the pandemic, the sales clerk would bring one bicycle out at a time. And I was a bystander, and Sydney was looking at each model of bicycle. And at one point, he brought out this bicycle. It looked pretty fancy with a lot of bells and whistles. And it had about 8 different sprockets on the back rear tire, which said to me it had a lot of different gears. And then I made, you could say, a tactical error. I volunteered an unsolicited opinion. And I said, and you're thinking, well, maybe you did that, John, but surely you didn't do the old when I was a kid thing. That's exactly what I did. I said, honey, now when I was a boy, I said, my bicycle only had one gear, only one sprocket, and I never had any problems at all. If I came to a hill, I just stood up on those pedals and I pedaled harder. And she looked at me very coolly, rather bemused, and said, well, my bicycle, when I was a kid, had 3 gears. And we bought that bicycle with 8 gears. Now, fast forward a couple of days, and we had a family event. We met out on the Campion Trail, which is out in Irving near Las Colinas. My 2 adult daughters, an adult son, and our grandchildren, we socially distanced on bicycles. I was on my skates. It's social distancing on wheels. And we put together a whole caravan, family caravan, going north. The sun was shining. It was idyllic. You could talk to the grandkids and everything. And the amazing thing about it was whether you were skating or pedaling, it was effortless. It was just wonderful. It was so joyful, I felt like we could go all the way to Oklahoma. It was just effortless. And the scenery, you wouldn't know you were near a metropolitan area, and we're having such great fellowship. And as a skater, I was behind my grandson, Sawyer. I called him Pace Car Jones. And Pace Car was setting the pace, and I was staying behind him, and it was wonderful. So that it was a terrible thing. When finally we realized we probably need to turn around and go back. We'd gone about 5 or 6 miles to the north. And so we stopped and we turned around, and immediately upon turning around, we had a terrible realization. The realization was that we had had a 30-mile-per-hour wind at our backs, virtually propelling us down the trail, and now we had to pedal or skate against the wind. And I mean, it took our breath away. It was terrible. We didn't even know if we were going to make it. We had to stop 3 different times. But I can tell you that Sydney had no problem at all pedaling her new bicycle. Why? Because she had the ability to shift to a very different gear, shift down so that she could pedal quickly with little effort and go against the wind. So it was because she was right. Yes, I said that. She was right, and she had the ability to shift gears and go against the wind. We got to the end. I said to my grandson, Hank, what did you think about that? He said, Granddad, I can't feel my legs. It was that tough. So if you were to ask the question, well, so how was it? How was the Campion Trail that day? I would have to say, well, it depends. Or if you said, what is the effect of a 30-mile-per-hour wind when you're on the trail? I would have to say, well, it depends. It's not a yes or no question. It depends on whether you're coming or going and whether you have the ability to shift gears. You see, I get concerned that sometimes we get moved into what they call false dichotomies, where people will ask, well, you like this or that? It's either or. Which is it? And they paint you into a corner. And sometimes it's not that simple. I'll give you an example. Sydney shared this with me. There was a viral tweet or posting that was going around from a motivational speaker during the pandemic. And the motivational speaker said, you know, if you haven't found, if you haven't during this pandemic developed a huge project or found a new skill or read multiple books, then you were not lacking the time, you were lacking the discipline. So I read that and I said, well, you know, there's a certain part of that that makes sense to me. But then a trauma psychologist responded to that post and said, this is the most awful thing I've ever read. During this pandemic, how can you be so callous? How can you be so thoughtless with what people are going through, the collective grief, the depression? Why would you put this big guilt trip on everybody? And so it sets up this dichotomy. Well, which is it? Are you a motivational type person who wants to get up and make a difference? Or are you the sort of person that wants to be in solidarity with the grief and the pain that's going on in the world? And I would say, well, my experience has been some days I wake up and I don't feel like doing anything. And maybe I am a little depressed. And other days I've gotten up and I said, you know, I'd still have an opportunity to go and make a difference. I can do a project in my office in the spare bedroom, a church project, and get some work done, or have a few video conferences and feel like I've really accomplished something. So my answer would be, well, it depends. Sometimes I do one and sometimes I do the other. I like to have the ability to shift gears. Well, it's the same thing with the reopening dialogue, isn't it? It's become very contentious, a lot of blaming, a lot of anger. Well, on the one hand, and it depends on how people frame the question. I mean, would you prefer to be sheltered at home and take care of yourself, or do you want to endanger yourself and others by going outside? Which is it? Which would you like to do? Or you could say, do you want to embrace your God-given rights as an American and go out and be free and continue on with your life, or do you want to be oppressed by government? And I would simply say, well, look, and this is really the definition of the word paradox. It doesn't have to be a dichotomy. A paradox is where two seemingly antithetical truths are simultaneously true at the same time. You can have both. And it creates a creative tension between them. And it gives you the challenge of shifting gears. One day you move towards one pole, the other day you're moving towards another pole. And paradox is an important part of our faith. So I wanted to give you two theological gears this morning that you could shift back and forth as you navigate your day and your journey. I hope that you will find it helpful. The first one is a theology of the cross. You heard the account of the crucifixion that Reverend Rob read to you, in which Jesus was on the cross calling out to God, saying in Aramaic that he felt he had been forsaken, abandoned. He was in great pain. It was a harsh and brutal means of execution. It was God's way of taking on the limitations of human existence. It was God's way of saying, I understand how hard it is to be a human being. I get it. I felt your pain, and we literally know that to be the case. Sometimes the pastoral task is simply to help people to sustain, to make it through the day. As a pastor, you might make a hospital call to someone with terminal cancer. And standing by the bed, you may understand that the prayer is, Lord, let this person get through pain today. Let them have a pain-free day as they continue their treatment. Sustain them. Help them to make it through the day. We can draw on the wisdom of children. You know, when you become an adult and you're hurt, your feelings get hurt, or you feel physical pain. That pain, you acknowledge it for about a nanosecond, and then it moves into something else, either anger or distress or anxiety. But children just stay right there with the pain. They say, ouch, that hurt. There's a tremendous amount of wisdom in that. Sometimes the right response is simply to say, ouch, this hurts. And the power, the skill that we can cultivate as disciples of Jesus Christ is to cultivate the ability to be in proximity to someone who's hurting and say, I feel your pain and I am here for you. I can't solve your problem. I'm not going to bore you and start throwing problem-solving techniques to you or tell you what you should have done. I simply will be here with you, and together we're going to figure this thing out. Together we're going to make it to the other side. In the Disney movie entitled McFarland, USA, Kevin Costner plays the part of a true story, a real-life coach by the name of Jim White, who went to the small town of McFarland, California. It's in the valley. It's a farming community. And the high school was populated by Latino students who worked really hard, would go to the fields in the morning before school, and then they would run to the school building. And as a coach, watching them do that and the speed in which so many of them were able to run, he decided it'd be a good idea to start a cross-country team. And within a matter of a couple of years, McFarland High School was winning state championships in California, beating the more affluent high schools of Palo Alto and those around the big cities, because he was able to harness this innate ability to overcome that was in the students. And he said to them, you know, cross-country running is painful. Everybody hurts. It's about stamina and endurance. And the way that you win a race is to endure the pain longer than your opponent. Here at Highland Park United Methodist Church, this people of God knows that our community is in pain. And we stand in solidarity with them. Not just in terms of a sense of presence, but also with a commitment. Every week, 17,500 meals are generated out of our church kitchen and delivered by church volunteers. This is our way not only of saying, ouch, we know it hurts, but also say, here, this can make it better. Together, we can feel each other's pain. We can respect what we're all going through during this time. And know that together we are going to make it through. We can see this to the other side. So that's one important gear, the theology of the cross, to feel people's pain. Jesus felt that pain. And it's powerful when people understand themselves to be understood. The second gear is what is known as a theology of glory. And this was illustrated in the Transfiguration. Jesus went up to the mountaintop with a select band of disciples. And you have this incredible transfiguration in which he becomes dazzling white and is lifted up with Moses and Elijah, and he's speaking with them. The disciples are seeing this, and then they hear a divine voice that says, "This is my son with whom I am well pleased." Can you imagine a more powerful affirmation? You talk about a mountaintop experience. Oh my goodness. No wonder the disciples wanted to remain in place there. Let's build some booths. Let's have a Six Flags over the Transfiguration and never leave this place. But Jesus said, no, we need to go back now. We need to go to the place of conflict and go to the place of the mundane and make a difference. But Jesus felt that joy. That divine affirmation, that exhilaration, the same type of exhilaration that the disciples felt on Pentecost, in which they were accused of nipping with the early morning wine. And Peter had to say, no, we haven't been hitting the bottle. We're just intoxicated with the Holy Spirit. They knew that joy. It's not a form of denial to go out and say, I'm happy to be a Christian. It's just an understanding of a different type of love. So much of what we do is contingent. I'll be happy when everything goes my way. Well, how often does that happen? Or I will love you and care for you as long as my heart leaps when you walk in the room, as long as we root for the same college football team. But Christians understand that agape love is different than that. It's in spite of. In spite of the fact that we might have a disagreement, in spite of the fact that we might have different points of view, I'm going to love you anyway, and there's nothing you can do about it. My love is unconditional. My love is in spite of. This was illustrated in, I'm dating myself here, but the Disney movie Pollyanna. You know, normally when you say, oh, that's so Pollyanna-ish, it's got a derogatory connotation. Oh, you're saccharine sweet. Oh, everything's so simplistic and naive. But in that movie, Hayley Mills, the young British actress, she played the lead part of Pollyanna. And she was the daughter of a missionary who had passed away. So she had to go live with her Aunt Polly, a very affluent woman who literally ran a town. But when she was disappointed and when she was accused of being Pollyanna-ish, she said, well, I played the glad game. And somebody said, well, what's that about? And she said, well, when we were on an island in the Pacific, twice a year we'd get a barrel from the church sending us supplies, and I'd requested a doll. So I was looking forward to getting my doll. The barrel finally arrived. We opened it up. Her father looked down, and the only thing in the barrel was a pair of crutches, not a doll for her. And she was incredibly disappointed. So her father said to her, well, let's play the glad game. Let's find out. Let's try to decide what is the blessing that we can find in this. So she thought about it and thought about it, and first of all, couldn't find any blessing at all. She wanted a doll. But then it occurred to her, you know, perhaps the blessing is that I don't need these crutches, that I've been blessed with the ability to walk. The book of Genesis teaches us in the narrative of the creation, the ability to pronounce blessings into existence. God said, let there be light. And there was light. The power of the Logos, the creative word, to pronounce blessings into existence. It is a skill that we must cultivate. Because what we realize is, in ordinary life, that you could have an attribute or a wonderful quality, or you could have a blessing in your life, but if you do not take the time to pronounce it into existence, it really doesn't exist at all. I'll give you an example. So in ancient Greece in 490 BC, the Persians were invading Greece. And as was the custom, the Greek army was sent out to the plains near the town of Marathon to meet the enemy. They left the city of Athens behind. Those who could not fight in the army remained behind, wondering anxiously, would they win the battle? Because if not, they would soon be enslaved and captured and taken away to a foreign land. So the battle was fought. The Greeks were great warriors, and they won the battle. They repelled the Persians. And when the battle was over, the commander of the Greek army turned to the swiftest soldier, and he said to him, now you run the 26 miles back to Athens, and you tell them of our victory. Because you see, even though the victory had been won on the plains, the people in Athens did not know that. It was not a present reality. Until the runner finally arrived, I imagine he had to catch his breath, and then he announced, victory is with us, we are saved. And it was pronounced into existence. You and I, we need to cultivate that ability. In television, they sometimes use a technique known as freeze frame, in which at the end, you know, at the end of Lonesome Dove, Captain Call returns to Lonesome Dove. He's walking on the bridge, Tommy Lee Jones, the actor, and then they freeze that picture at the end as the credits begin to roll. Freeze frame. If you can cultivate the ability to look around the mundane events in your life and say, oh my goodness, bang, that's it right there. What a blessing. What an amazing thing. You and I, we kind of walk through our lives zombie-like and we say, well, you know, I've been to the museum, I've seen Van Gogh's painting Wildflowers, and the next time I see an arrangement of flowers that looks like that, I guess I'll paint it also. But guess what? The arrangement of flowers that he used as a model didn't look like that. He had to invest his imagination. and invest his joy and his sense and his artist's eye in order to transform it from the ordinary into the extraordinary. And you and I need to be artists who have that capability. And I'll give you an example. So Sydney and I went to see our middle daughter up in Little Elm. We were going for a dinner that was going to be outdoors where we could socially distance. And she was wondering, our one-year-old grandson, she'd kept him every Tuesday until this pandemic. And it'd been months since she had seen him, and she was wondering, would he even recognize her? It was a real anxiety on her part. We pulled in the driveway, she got out, and then he came out of the door and he saw her. His face just lit up, and he called to her, "To mommy, to mommy." And I said to myself, that's a freeze frame moment. He recognizes and loves her so great. The second gear is a theology of glory. So you can use both of those. You can alternate. You don't have to choose in between them. And you don't have to accuse and be blaming and angry with people who are using the other gear when you're over here. In fact, it should promote tolerance as you understand the language and what they're doing. And you try to bring the two together. Now, you and I, as we try to make it through this pandemic, we have the ability to look to history, to the cloud of witnesses of the saints, and ask the question, well, how did they do it? We say to ourselves, there's no precedent for what we're going through. There's almost a narcissistic ring to it. But let me tell you, in 1637, in the village of Eilenburg, Germany, there was a Lutheran priest by the name of Martin Rinkert. He was caring for his parish, but his parish was having a lot of problems. They were surrounded by the 30-year war, so there was a lot of war, a lot of people being killed with casualties. In addition, there was a great famine because the war was taking away the ability to grow crops. And then on top of that, there was a plague that was decimating and killing people. In this small village, over 8,000 people were killed by the plague. Imagine, you think about that for a moment as we look every evening on the news and we see the totals of casualties in our country, in the world, in our county, in our state. In one small village, 8,000 casualties, and he had to bury 4,000 of them, sometimes doing 50 funerals, 50 burials a day. He buried all the other clergy in the village. He had to do all the services. He didn't understand. Why had God spared him? Why didn't he get it? He didn't understand as he ministered to people, prayed with the people, comforted the people, buried the people. Finally, the village was surrounded by the Swedish army to make, you know, as the final salt in the wound. Their gates were surrounded by the Swedes, and the general of the Swedish army demanded the equivalent of $30,000 in order to give them their freedom. And Rinkert had the wall, the opening gate of the village gate opened, and he walked out and confronted the general, and he fell to his knees, and he said, "We have nothing. We have nothing. Grant us mercy. Please let us be free." And the general refused. So Rinkert prayed to God and said, "Lord, we have no mercy from men. We turn to you for refuge." And in the midst of that plea, the Swedish general's heart was moved. He was moved by the sight of this Lutheran priest, this Lutheran village priest, praying on his knees for the well-being of his people. And he said, "Okay, I grant you your freedom." It was the same Lutheran priest who'd been through all this suffering, who'd endured this crucible, who was able to sit down at his desk and write the lyrics for this hymn, in which he said, "Now thank we all our God with heart and hands and voices, who wondrous things has done, in whom this world rejoices."